You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And for Dear Science this week, we are joined once again by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Caster.
And it's a later afternoon than last time.
Indeed it is. Yeah. Yes, those hours, they just, you know, melt away magically, don't they?
I've been enjoying the extra sun, though I will say this morning I was, surprised at how cold it was. I thought daylight savings, you know, later mornings would be a bit warmer. No, not at all. Just as cold as it was last week.
Yes, we're getting into autumn, aren't we? Unfortunately.
Yeah, but it's a shame. And so now we're going to learn, how do we pronounce multiple... I said sclerosis.
You did, yeah.
Is that correct?
Yep, that's all good.
Oh, yes. Wow. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Well, what are we researching? What's the...
Well, this might seem a slight sort of detour, but you start off in the first week of October, all the scientists around the world get excited because that's when the Nobel Prizes are announced. And, you know, they're the pinnacle of scientific prizes. Everybody knows all about the Nobel Prizes, long history, et cetera, et cetera. There are other scientific prizes out there. There's a thing called the Wolf Prize, which a lot of winners of the Wolf Prize have gone on to win the Nobel Prize. And there's now a thing called the Breakthrough Prize. And this has been funded by Sergey Brin, one of the guys behind Google, and dear old Mark Zuckerberg, Mr. Facebook. Amongst other people, and these are $3 million per prize.
Ooh, that's a
which
large
is actually
sum.
which is more than the Nobel Prize.
Wow,
the Nobel Prize is only about only it's about $1 million per prize. Okay,
and so I'm guessing the breakthrough.
I'd take it.
it's for a new. A fresh introduction?
Well, it's sort of new discoveries in fundamental physics, life sciences, and mathematics. So it's only those three parts of science. And so they've just been announced over the weekend. And so one of these awards went to two people who've been very interested in the study of multiple sclerosis, which is just this nasty, nasty disease where basically the body's immune system starts essentially attacking itself, attacking the body. And it's just, you know, it's just horrible. And you end up with sort of cognitive paralysis, motor paralysis, and ultimate death. And, you know, it's not a very nice way to go. It affects around about 3 million people worldwide. So anything that can be done, obviously, to alleviate this, to look for a cure and everything, is going to be big news.
Yeah.
And so this Breakthrough Prize was awarded to an American neurologist by the name of Stephen Hauser and an Italian epidemiologist by the name of Alberto Acerio. Okay. And they were looking at MS, multiple sclerosis, from sort of two different aspects, I guess. So Hauser, he started off about 45 years ago. So he's been doing this for a long time. And he was moved to study this because he met a young MS sufferer who was in her 20s, and then he just saw her gradual progression downhill and everything, and just horrible. And so he sort of devoted his life to finding a cure for this thing. And way back when he started, this was in the 70s, there was no cure at that stage. And not so much that there's a cure now, but there's certainly, you know, something where you can...
We can alleviate.
And so it was thought at the time that these things called T-cells.
T-cells
in the immune system. So
I've heard of T-cells. Yeah,
exactly. A lot of people have. So white blood cells in the immune system. And it was thought that they were the culprits, but he had a different idea. He thought that B cells, which are another type of white blood cell, he reckoned that they were the cause of all of this. And he was busy trying to get the funding agencies to take note of this, to, you know, sort of show that, yes, it's not the T cells, it's the B cells. And the funding agencies just said, no, we don't believe this. Very, very unlikely. Didn't fund him. Luckily, a big sort of pharma company, Genentech, over in the States, got behind him. And basically, they backed his testing. And he came up with treatments that were targeting the B cells, and he found that you would get about a 90% reduction in brain inflammation.
That sounds quite good.
Yeah. And so that was, you know, basically he showed that, no, it wasn't what everybody thought. It was, you know, it's something else. So he's sort of right down to the actual cause of MS. And if you can just pin down the cause, then finding a treatment becomes obviously a lot more facile. And Acerio, the Italian guy, very interesting. So epidemiologist. So that's a study of sort of the way that diseases propagate and everything, you know. So, and he was very interested in the fact that MS, and again, I did not know this, that MS occurs primarily in the Northern Hemisphere. Didn't know that. Mm. And it doesn't seem to occur very much in the tropics.
Interesting. Very so maybe affected by heat.
Yeah. And so because of that, he came to the conclusion, oh, hang on, maybe it's a virus. Because this apparently is sort of typical viral behavior. And
virus is more common in the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah, and that, you know, you're right, that, you know, they can be affected by heat or whatever. Mm. So he sort of put two and two together. And so that started a study of over 1 million US military recruits.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Over around about 20 years. And what he eventually found was a link between MS and this thing called Epstein-Barr virus.
Mm, that doesn't sound great.
Epstein-Barr virus is the same thing that gives you glandular fever, or mono, as they call it, over in the States. And so basically what he found was that not everybody who has Epstein-Barr virus will go on to get MS, but everybody who has had MS has had the Epstein-Barr virus.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. So there's
That's pretty compelling. Yeah,
absolute causal link between the two. You know.
Wow.
So two massive pieces of research. You know, thoroughly deserving of being awarded these prizes and stuff, and you know,
helping us move forward to dealing with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Fabulous.
Yeah, and then next year we've got marriage linked to dementia. This seemed like a bit of a funny one. I recently found out an interesting fact about schizophrenia, which I think you'd find a little bit interesting, doesn't occur for anyone who is congenitally blind.
Good grief.
Not a single case.
Wow.
Yeah. But on with dementia.
Wow, wait, okay.
Yeah, and marriage. It just occurred to me at the same time. But yeah, dementia and marriage.
Yeah, dementia and marriage. So they really do come up with the most amazing things that they try to correlate, you know, never fails to amaze me, all of these sort of medical sort of social science research type people. So these are researchers at Florida State Uni in the States, obviously, and Montpellier in France. And what they've found was that older adults who are either divorced or who have never married have a lower risk of developing dementia. And this is a result of an 18-year study. And these are all in comparison. So these numbers are in comparison with their married peers.
Mm.
Okay. So what did they do? So they had around about 24,000 volunteers. So, you know, decent number.
Yeah.
And so these were people at the start of the study who didn't have dementia. And basically what they did, they were subjected to, I use the phrase subjected to, probably come up with something better, but subjected to an annual clinical evaluation over, so each year over 18 years. So that, you know, really takes some sort of doing. You've got to be really sort of committed to it if you're going to volunteer for something like this.
Yeah.
You're right, it's a lot of data. It's 122,000 person years of data.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you'd be happy with that as a researcher, I can imagine.
You would, absolutely, yep, because, you know, the more data, the better, you know, the more certain your results are. And so of these 24,000 people, they had to take account of a whole bunch of variables, so demographics, so mental and physical health, genetic risk factors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of these sorts of things you have to correct for to make sure that that's not sort of biasing your results. And so at the start of the study, the participants would self-describe as married, widowed, divorced, or never married.
Mm.
So you're in one of those four categories. And so what they found, the divorced and the never married cohort showed a lower risk of developing dementia over the study period, over the 18-year study period. So in terms of numbers, as the study went on, so of these 24,000 people, 20% of them actually developed dementia.
Is that a standard rate?
Good question. Very, very good question.
20% sounds like
20%,
a lot.
You know, that's 1 in 5. You know, that's quite frightening if that's what's happening in the general population. But of the 20% that did develop dementia, so 21.9% of married and 21.9% of widowed, so developed dementia.
Yeah.
Okay. And so contrast that with 12.8% of the divorced
and 12.4%
of the never married.
Wow.
Yeah. 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 So the interesting thing about this is they'd actually studied this before, believe it or not, looking for some sort of link, and they didn't find any. So they found, in fact, the exact opposite, that people who were married were less likely to develop dementia. So
maybe it's changed over time.
What we have now is a problem, obviously. So, you know, 24,000 participants, you'd think that this would be a fairly robust sort of study, and they found something entirely at odds with what has been found before. So. You know, I've got to say I'm safe. So
I'm wondering about the difference between widowed and divorced. I find it, I guess, surprising that there's such a shocking gap between those two.
Yes, yeah, indeed.
You'd think it would be, I guess, closer. Maybe not exactly the same, but not as far apart as 12 to 20.
No, fascinating stuff that. So, you know, if you want to avoid this in your older age, don't get married, folks.
Yeah, that's the safe move.
Or get divorced. One or the other.
There's always a way out, I suppose. And then lastly here, we've got a particle collider in Europe. How big are, I guess, before we get into this even larger particle collider, how big are standard particle colliders?
Well, there's really only the big one.
We've just got one. Okay. Right.
We've got ones that go on a line. We've got linear accelerators and colliders, and then we've got this big circular one under France and Switzerland, and that's called the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, which...
It's got large in the name.
Yeah. So it says it all, really. Does what it says in the box. And it is the largest science experiment or piece of scientific kit in the world. Okay. And interesting, because 1 year ago today, a guy by the name of Peter Higgs passed away. And he was responsible for the discovery. Or no, he wasn't responsible for the discovery. He was responsible for proposing this thing called the Higgs boson.
I've heard of the Higgs boson.
Right, which is a particle, a fundamental particle that gives things mass. Now, don't ask me how the hell that works. I had no idea. But a year ago today, he passed away. And it was because of the Large Hadron Collider that, looking for this Higgs boson, you know, he theoretically predicted it, said it should exist. They did the experiment on this piece of kit. It's the only piece of kit in the world where they could do this, and they actually discovered
the
Higgs boson, okay? And so it's a massive scientific discovery. Now, the LHC is going to become obsolete eventually.
Yes.
And they're looking at around about sort of the 2040s, where it's going to be sort of, past its prime. And so they are, like all good scientists, making plans to replace it with something better.
Yeah.
And so what they've got at the moment, they've got a 27-kilometre long circular accelerator, okay, where these particles are accelerated up to near the speed of light, and then they bash into each other. And you see what you get out. Basically, that's basically
a fun little
hit something with a big hammer. See what transpires.
Yeah.
So the new one that they are proposing now is going to be 91 kilometers long.
Oh, that's a substantial increase.
It is a substantial increase. And using that, they're going to be able to get 8 times the energies that they can currently get.
Right.
And so that's going to allow them to look at matter in even more detail, and particularly the stuff called dark matter or dark energy, because a lot of the universe is made of this, and we haven't got a clue what that's all about.
No idea.
We don't
know. We might, once we have this 91-kilometer-long collider.
Right, absolutely.
Collider.
Yep. And so this is called the Future Circular Collider.
Okay? Skipping large now, future.
Yeah. Now, the really interesting bit about this is the price. Okay. You might think it's squillions. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a mere $17 billion.
A mere $17 billion.
Now, look, you know, that does sound like a lot, but the numbers getting bandied around over the past few days, $3 trillion has come off the,
It does sound like a steal, right, for 91 kilometres of incredibly advanced scientific technology.
That won't even sort of become fully online until about 2070. there and thereabouts.
Well,
so we can imagine the price is probably going to go up by then, because it always does. But, okay, so here's a ridiculous suggestion. Okay, so let's say that you've got buttloads of money and you want to be remembered for all the right things rather than all the wrong things. And you want to be a philanthropist, okay?
Right, yeah.
And let's say you bought this thing called Twitter for $44 billion. Dollars,
yeah,
you know.
Well,
you've got $17 billion running around in your back pocket.
Certainly, yeah. I'd imagine if you had the kind of money to spend even more than that, you've probably got some extra.
Yes.
Lying about,
and you would think, right, if you want to be remembered for the good things, maybe just pay the whole $17 billion,
yeah,
and name it after yourself.
They could put the name on it. Yeah,
you could put your damn name on it.
Scientists, I've heard, are very fond of actually taking money and putting people's names on on the things afterwards. Yeah.
So, you know, a certain person, if you're listening to this, you know, have a wee think.
Have a wee
think.
You
know, see what you want to be remembered for.
Or anyone else with $17 billion
there. Yes.
Your name could be on the world's largest collider.
There you go.
Yeah. So. And potentially support scientific discoveries for years to come. A century, even?
Yes.
Yeah.
Incredible work. So that's my proposal for anybody out there with cash burning a hole in their pocket.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing these inspiring and a little bit scary science story with us today. As always, thank you for coming in. Thank you, Moshat, and thank you, science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Moshat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.